People have their phones out because John Bronson is scary too. Basement boy, the guy from TV. And again, she orders him to leave. But he won't. Like a soldier, she moves her squirt gun into firing position in one swift gesture, and John cowers. He puts his hands up like some kind of a criminal. People are laughing, and I think my heart is breaking. She hates him. Always did.
Take your shorts off, she says. Let's see what you got in there.
Noel, I'm sorry, he says. I'll go. She pumps her gun and he flinches, as if it isn't full of water, harmless water. I don't even think he can see me, and I feel like I can't see me, can't feel me. This is how it was when we were kids sometimes, when Carrig would do something cruel to him and I'd freeze up. And then John speaks. I just wanted to say hi. Noel cackles.
I just wanted to say hi. Are you a fucking dog? Are you a dog?
No, he says. Oh, John, don't. Don't. There is no stopping Noel. Noel and her mouth. Her gun.
Let me lay it down for you, basement boy. First you ruined her life by being here, acting like she should save your life or some shit. Then you ruin her life by leaving.
I was kidnapped, he says, trembling.
And then you ruined it again by coming back.
She takes aim. This time he doesn't flinch. There is no laughter left in the room. Phones are down. This is a horrible thing to see.
Chloe doesn't love you, John. She feels sorry for you.
She pumps her gun again. And then, just like that, her nose starts bleeding. Her breath comes in a rasp and she drops to the floor. And then we're all screaming, moving. Someone steps on my hand while I'm trying to hoist myself out of the pool. I can't see through the people, and finally I get out. I'm running along the edge of the pool and there is shrieking. Someone call 911! I push my way through the crowd. John is gone. The slider is open. He didn't bother to close it. In the middle of all this chaos, he hurts me again. I get it now. That's what John does. He disappears. And Noelle never disappears. She's the most dogged person I've ever known. Her favorite movie was Election, and she could do anything. When we did that dance routine, she withheld our yogurts until we mastered our moves. Even when she was weak, there was something strong about her where it was hard to believe that she was afraid of anything. Last week, in Forever 21 in the dressing room, she quivered, "What if I get to Dartmouth and everyone's way smarter and just better?" I remember this one time at a spelling bee, this other girl made fun of her accent. I remember how Noelle looked her right in the eye.
My voice is my favorite thing about me because it makes it so easy to spot the pretentious snobs like you.
She's my best friend, my first friend, my flawed friend. And now she's flat on her back on the pool deck. Dead. I am Providence. 6 years later.
Eggs. Lowe has dozens of students. Every semester there are more of them. In and out of our house for dinner, for coffee. There are always a few favorites. And right now it's all about Marco. He's not a bad kid. It's just the little things. The way he tucks his hair behind his ears. Repeats everything that comes out of Lowe's mouth. As if he hasn't already won her over. Lowe says I'm too hard on him, on everyone. He's just trying to commit things to memory, Aggie. A lot of writers do that. I have kids too, sort of. Mine just don't come over the house for pasta. They don't cry on the sofa about their evil boyfriends and their impossible professors. My kids can't do any of that because my kids are dead. Lo knocks on the wall downstairs. Marco's coming over for dinner. I'll alert the media. She sighs, but she's not mad. Lo doesn't like to come up here to my unofficial home office. Once upon a time, it was our boy Chucky's room, but he doesn't live here anymore. And that isn't because he's away at college. He'll never go to college. He's 8 years old. Stricken. Some doctors call it autism, but it's not the kind you see on TV or at the park. Others tell us it's a mood disorder, a neurological affliction. The bottom line is that our boy has a mess inside of his mind. A mess no one can figure. He was violent when he was with us, trying to set himself on fire, pulling his own hair, the screaming, the wordless pain in his only language, the shrieking. We were no good for him, couldn't protect him from his pain. They told us we had no choice. We had to send him to a special residential facility at Bradley Hospital. And there he lives. There he sleeps. It's not your fault, not anyone's fault. But that's easier said than done with this. The kind of nightmare that makes your friends forget to call you back. There is a God because so few kids are sick this way. But there is no God because this is my kid, our boy, on the other side of town, with rubber walls around him. And so, of course, Lo has her kids. Of course, I have my kids. You have to survive. Back before Chucky was born, we were excited. Lo wanted ducks everywhere in his room, and we bought every duck thing we saw. Soft, stuffed ducklings, ceramic ducklings. We found at an art for art's sake kind of store out in Newport. And then he was born. Quiet. I prayed for him to be loud, boisterous. It's too painful for Lo to be up here now. The walls still flush with ducks, ducks we stenciled when we were expectant. When she would come home high on a Hemingway lecture, giddy over Make Way for Ducklings. She had her favorite pages of that book framed, hung. It's duck soup in here. My lamp is a duck, and the bureau meant for his knickers is home base for an army of dusty rubber duckies. Then there's my desk, a cargo ship in a duck pond. We got it a few years back at a tag sale in Cranston. We love this kind of furniture, the kind that makes you think of Cary Grant and cigarette smoke. Lo squeezed my hand. You know where this could go. The back corner of the living room? She looked down into her purse. Or maybe Chucky's room. So we put my desk up here. Now you have somewhere to do your research, Eggy. She rubbed my back. I should have seen it coming. Lo was no fan of my research. I was trying to figure out why our boy was the way he was. The doctors said you can't go there. But it's in my nature to solve the puzzle, to go with my gut. I had so many angles. I was investigating the bones of our house. Was there something in the walls? Something that got into Lo while Chucky was gestating? Some chemical in the insulation? I had calls out to the manufacturers of the milk we had at home, the milk they use at Dunkin' Donuts. I was online finding other parents. Did they go to Dunkin' Donuts? Lo would see me on the floor with my boxes and papers spread out. One day she spotted a bottle of her perfume on the floor. Angel. She grabbed it. What's this? She sniped. Lo, I said, I'm doing this for us, for everyone. If there's something in the perfume, well, maybe there's a way to reverse it, help other people from being in this situation. She walked away. She'd never yell at me. We'd been to hell together. Our Chucky never laughed. You could hold him, but he wouldn't hold you. He wouldn't rest his head on your shoulder, wouldn't lean into you. You scream less when you've been through that kind of thing. And a week after that incident with the perfume, I was up here with my desk. We have our system worked out. I haven't even been to see Chucky since we dropped him off, whereas, Lo, she goes all the time. She isn't a martyr about it, but it's there, brimming. And once in a while she'll confront me. You spend all that time up there with your boxes, and maybe if you saw him, maybe you'd be able to relax and just be. My alarm goes off on my phone, which means my tea is ready. I drink Throat Coat, marshmallow root tea. Lo can't stand it. Too sweet and soothing. But I love this stuff. It's tender. You have to steep it for 15 minutes, covered. It's just like they say on the box, gives you this inner layer of protection. Protection from what? Lo always wants to know. My phone rings, as it often does this time of night. I sit back in my chair and prepare for the deluge. Maddie, I say, how are you doing tonight, my dear? Maddie Goleb's son, Richie, died in his yard. He was only 23. Another coronary, one of the four unexplained that's happened in the past few years. His mother calls me every few months. She gets on a tear, thinks there's more to the story. Whenever Lo accuses me of being obsessive, I think of Maddie, living proof that time doesn't heal all wounds. Not wholly. I never tell her to stop crying. I just wait. She blows her nose. Aggie, she says. I had a dream last night. My heart sinks for us both. There's nothing I can do with dreams. I listen as she describes the color of Richie's shirt, the vein bulging on his forehead. But I'm only humoring her. I'm like those Harvard mucky mucks who tolerated me when I would go in there with Chucky's file, tell them about my theories. The answer was always going to be no. Thanks for coming by, but your kid's on the lonely end of the spectrum. And sometimes I wish they had told me to piss off. Sometimes I think I'll tell Maddie to piss off. Maybe that would help her. But not tonight. I take copious notes. I follow up with questions. This time she dreamed that Richie came home.
Aggie, she says, he didn't just come home this time. Normally I hug him, you know, I hold him, but this time he was cold. He gave me an envelope.
What was in it?
I tried to hug him, but it was like he couldn't cross over.
Did you take the envelope?
There he is, my one and only, and he won't come in, and he wants me to open this envelope, and I want him to come in, and he says the man in the envelope broke his heart.
I make a note. Broke his heart. He wasn't seeing anyone at the time, was he, Maddie?
No,
she says.
He'd broken up with Brian. Brian, who didn't even go to his funeral.
Then she's crying again. It's more of a spasm, as if there are earthquakes in her heart. And then she's fine again. Back to her dream.
When I opened the envelope, there was nothing in there.
I bring things back to the physical reality. I ask her if she's gotten any strange mail over the years, but she cuts me off.
Let me finish my dream,
she says.
He stole my envelope.
I put down my pen. Who did, honey?
The guy who broke his heart, she says. The man in the dream. He got to the envelope before me. I saw him running out of my house with it.
It's a painful thing to hear yourself in another person. Maddie finishes her story, and she says what she always says.
A heart doesn't just break for no reason.
I turn the light off, so I can't see anything but my computer screen. So I can't see the ducks on the wall. I pick up my tea. It's cold. And then, a little while later, the doorbell rings. Marco. Lo is always animated when her kids are here, especially Marco. I think he has a crush on her. When I said so the other night, she laughed at me.
I'm almost old enough to be his mother.
But here he is on his iPod, finding music for her. Lo thinks I'm jealous of him because he's young. And maybe I am a little envious. His goddamn able body. And me. I've got a new little ache every day, a pinch in my gut. Marco, he's just so damn blonde, chiseled. His ski-sloped face, his unnecessarily blue eyes. Any man would be annoyed. He's so alive. And my kids are so dead.
So I think I have a title,
he says, wiping the corners of his mouth. Lo grins.
For your thesis? Is it Darkness and Light?
I improved on that, he says. That's why I don't like him. A better kid would say yes, let Lo have the win. He bites his lip, white man's overbite. And he says it like he's a magician.
The darkness at the end of the tunnel.
Lo jumps overboard.
That's eloquent and compelling.
Marco says he was inspired by something she said in class. She freezes up. He's overstepping somehow. And I look at him directly for the first time. What was that, Marco? He looks at her for approval, but she just swallows.
She told us about your family, he says. The naming through generations. The men all named Charles de Benedictus. You're young, you go by Eggs, and your Eggs until you have a son, and then you become Chucky and your son is Eggs. But with your situation,
he tucks his hair behind his ears.
It broke my heart. The notion of you being Eggs forever, no end.
Marco puts down his iPod, and Lo looks at me.
Eggie, she says, it's my smallest class. You know all the kids.
I know Lo's teaching style. I have no grounds to be wounded. Am I complaining?
No. She says. Marco, honey, did you want more bread?
And this is where I kind of do like Marco. He apologizes for being so blunt. He means it. He's a good kid. The kind of kid I wanted Chucky to be. And I can't be mad at Lo for talking about me and our son when I haven't seen him in 2 years.
2 years.
And still, she lets me sit at this table. I wink at her. She nods. She knows. She and Marco start talking about a band that's playing downtown next week. I eat my pasta. This is what happens when your kid is sick. You wind up with someone else's offspring, sitting down as if he's yours. He picks up on my gloom. Looks at me.
I have to ask, he says. Do you ever have to break up any fights at Lupo's?
Lo laughs.
Thank God, no, she says. Eggie's a detective. It's mostly paperwork. Anyway, Marco, tell us more about your paper.
I twist my fork into the pasta. Actually, I had an interesting call about a cold case tonight. Marco's eyes light up. It's a given with Lowe's kids that they're always mining you for stories. They love to hear about our chief, Stacy, this ultimate character, a woman with five kids running a police force. Lowe reads me excerpts of their short stories, all the different versions of Stacy. In truth, she's not very interesting. Not to me, anyway. Lowe's fork drops into his salad bowl.
A cold case?
Marco perks up.
Is this about those kids with the heart attacks, officer?
I nod. Lowe bites her lip. I will pay for this later. I heard from a mother of a victim tonight. Now, this might be nothing, but police work is more about your gut instinct, I say, channeling my old man. It's about thinking, imagination. It's about looking away from the autopsy report and thinking about the body, asking the right questions, trusting your gut above all else, because that's your own little internet right there. That's your gut. And the way you pore over your writing, I pore over the facts. Lowe grabs onto that word.
Facts,
she says, eyeing me. Anyhow, I say, it turns out that one of these kids, well, there might have been a person of interest that we didn't know about until just now. Marco nods. He's half listening, half observing, like all of Lowe's kids. I can see him using me already. Knows more than he should about me. Lowe has opened up to him.
My husband and his boxes. You know those boxes have gotten him into trouble? He was on probation a couple of years ago because he won't let go of this theory that these deaths are related and this is the sort of thing that could cost him his job. But there he is, night after night, up there with his boxes.
Anyhow, I say, it's sensitive material, and I have to leave it at that. And then we're back to talking about Marco's life, his paper, his housemates. They made up a drinking game where you have to say Nancy, Ancy, Ancy three times fast. The three of us sit here like dingbats, croaking, Nancy, Ancy, Ancy, Nancy, Ancy, Ancy, Nancy, Ancy, Ancy. I watch Lowe. I wonder how much trouble I'm going to be in after dinner. After we finish and clear the plates, Marco unplugs his phone from the charger. He yawns, faking it.
I guess I should be hitting the road.
Lowe grabs his arm.
You can't leave without dessert, she says.
She's never ready for good night.
Do you like brownies, Marco?
Love 'em, he says. And that's my cue. I pop the brownies in the microwave and listen to Lowe and Marco discuss a documentary Lowe has to see on Netflix. I watch the frostbite melt on the brownies. Marco laughs at something Lowe said. She smiles because it feels good when you tell a kid a story and the kid reacts. I wish Marco were my son. I wish my son were Marco. The brownies go round and round, and I wish Maddie had been calling about anything other than a goddamn dream.
I'm not mad,
Lowe says.
Are you mad?
Of course not.
I'm just looking out for you, Eggie. It's just not smart. It's one thing if I tell a vague story about us, about you, but you're on thin ice when you tell these kids about specific cases. You know, what if Marco goes home and writes about one of your cases? He writes about a heart attack and he gets back to a family and the family calls Stacy. Then you're out of a job.
I know. We settle into the bed and we try to get close to each other, but we're tired and we're off. We put on a movie, American Splendor, and we sit there in the glow of the TV like kids staying up past their bedtime. We're both 49. We're both from Rhode Island. We both fell in love with this house because it's weird, and we like weird. We both feel a strong sense of civic duty and actively use the library and the post office to ensure that our neighborhood remains just that. We both cried when Buddy Cianci passed away, mayor, husband of Nancy Ann Cianci. We both rejoiced when we realized what we had found in each other, one night in a movie theater, when we went into the wrong show and nearly killed ourselves laughing, stifling our laughter. The way she squeezed my hand, that thing when there is no one else on earth whose laugh could fuel you, whose hand could hold you. We're both inherently grateful people. A cop and a teacher, Marco will probably write in a story one day. Servants with imagination. A more compatible couple you could not find. She's eyeing me.
You're so quiet, E.
I'm just thinking. She hits pause. I prepare for the lecture.
You and your boxes.
She sighs. I stare at the TV. Harvey Pekar, he and his wife, they fell into a child, adopted a girl, a grown girl.
Eggie, you know I don't want to lecture you.
Lo, I know. And Lord, do I know that the odds are against me. Every autopsy is conclusive. Aortic rupture. Their hearts broke the same way hearts do, and it's bad luck that they should all go in my territory. Me with my overactive imagination, my gut and my boxes.
But honey, she says, sometimes it's just about one little step.
I look at her. I wait.
We could get out of the bed and get in the car. We could drive to Bradley.
Chucky. All this time she's been thinking about Chucky.
You don't even have to go in, she says. We could just sit in the parking lot.
When she puts the movie back on, I send a text to Maddie. I was thinking about your dream. Might be worth having another look at his email account. The thing about these cases, you think you've looked at everything, but sometimes you go back, it all looks different to you. She writes back a couple minutes later.
Sorry, detective, and a big thank you for being there for me in my crazy moments. I had a good visit with my sister and her kids. I'm calmer now. No more paranoid calls from me, I promise. I know you have real cases to solve. Sorry again.
I put my phone away. I never feel calmer. I wonder what that's like.
John. This is where Yvonne Belzicki died. Right here. Right on Dorrance Street. I had only been here a couple days and I was walking around, circling a nightclub called Lupo's Heartbreak Hotel. That's what I did to Noelle. I broke her heart. I was sure of it. I was sweaty and overheated after she died. As if I had used my own hands to reach in there and twist her arteries, shredding them until my knuckles were raw, red. I hadn't meant to do it. I would never do that to anyone. But I had done it. I'd been trying to understand what Noelle did that caused my body to flare up like that, but it wasn't fair to blame Noelle. I killed her. Me. I hated it when people blamed my mother's loose parenting style for what Roger Blair did to me. You can't blame the victim. You blame the kidnapper, the murderer. And now I was the murderer, like it or not. Noelle did not deserve to die. And then, one day, right here on Dorrent Street, there she was, though I didn't know her name. Yvonne Belziki. I liked every part of her. Her legs, her fingertips, all of her. And it wasn't a Chloe kind of love. She just looked full of goodness. She smiled at me, and it was contagious. I hadn't made eye contact with anyone since Noelle died, but I looked at Yvonne and thought, things can get better. Her eyes latched onto mine, and I should have run then, should have looked away because my heart was pumping in a way it hadn't since Noelle died. I should have run. Instead, I froze, a venomous deer in headlights. And for the first time, I really listened, and I could hear the change in me, as if Roger had rewired my insides, added a circuit system between my emotions and these invisible bullets bursting out of me. Yvonne went fast, maybe even faster than Noelle. I tried to do a better job of keeping to myself. I only walk at night, no eye contact, no chance of anyone getting to me. Sometimes I get paranoid and swear someone is following me, and those nights I go straight home where I'm safe, and so is everyone else. I focus on my plan. I can't find Roger Blair. No one can. But I try. I do my research. I concentrate on the science of it. Read about Blair, his other experiments. The guy he worked with at Brown, Dr. Terence Meany. If I can figure out what he did and how he did it, maybe I can fix it. Science could blow your mind. Chemistry in particular, with the codes and the numbers and the potassium, the chloride. And when I can't take the equations anymore, I step away from all the long, unwieldy words in the bio books and move over to the long, unwieldy words in the Lovecraft books. Cthulhu, Necronomicon. After all, there's no denying that I'm a monster. And maybe the key is learning how to tame these powers. I hate that word. I read about Lovecraft, the writer, the letters he wrote to his friends, his stories, but everything is cycles, seasons, and sure enough, after a few days of Dunwich life, I get weary. I'm back online, in Wired, in science. Part of the problem is there's no name for what I am, what I do. I don't know why my mom and Chloe and my dad only fainted while Noelle and Yvonne died. The romantic part of me thinks it has something to do with love, but that feels indulgent, silly, nothing to do with science, with the heat of my jets as they take off, one heart attacking another. Providence is the best place for me. A lot of quiet, open streets. I pace around the city the way Lovecraft did in his day. I walk and wonder, where is Roger Blair? That's the only way I'm going to figure it all out. Deep down, I know it, and it gets to me. The feeling that all my research, my reading, it's all a waste of time. I'll never find him, never fix it. And I can't live like this, the danger I put into the world just by walking down the street. But then another month goes by. The college kids arrive and grow, and I stay. In my same basement apartment, in my same job delivering papers for the Providence Journal. The thing I keep realizing is that there is no bottom of the heart, no darkest moment of your life. There is only darker, darker still. Noelle died because I was mad at her. Yvonne died because I smiled at her. Cody died because I was so upset about Carrig and Chloe. There's no end to the frustration, the curiosity, the horror that my feelings are poisonous. They have consequences for other people. And it's maddening. It's stupid. As if the act of feeling is undesirable, as if highs and lows aren't the whole point of life. To be mad at Noelle, to be dizzy over a beautiful girl on a spring day, as if we all don't want to live at Lupo's Heartbreak Hotel. I remember what Beverly once said about the cycle of abuse. That I shouldn't be surprised if I had thoughts about hurting someone, that it was natural for a victim to repeat that kind of behavior. I remember how hard I meant it when I told her that I had no desire to hurt anyone ever. And then the tears came, hard as the waves, harder. My dad used to have crazy dreams. My mom would groan. Dreams are like exercise. No one wants to hear about it. Now I have crazy dreams. I see all the people I killed. I try to save them, but there are no clues in my useless goddamn dreams. Roger Blair's there, but he doesn't help me. He doesn't listen when I scream. He doesn't open up and explain what he did, how to stop it. 5 people and 1 dog. Dead. Because of me. Where the fuck are you, Roger Blair? He might be going by Magnus Villers, and I understand why he became Magnus. He had ideas that no one wanted to hear, things he could only do as another person. I'm the same way, which is why I gave up my life as John Bronson. I have 2 names now, Theo Ward and Peter Fader. Theo Ward, a mashup of Lovecraft's pen names, Lewis Theobald and Ward Phillips, is a normal dude, rents the basement apartment, delivers papers for the Providence Journal. I have an email account for Theo, but it's never that exciting. I do all my science work under my other name, Peter Fader. Peter is for Peter Parker, Spider-Man, and Fader is for Lenny Fader, grown-ups too. I came up with the name on the first night of my paper route. I was so tired, so new to this place. I didn't even have a mattress. I turned on the TV, a leave behind from the last guy who lived here. Grown-ups 2 was on. I sat there on the floor and I laughed. I actually laughed. There were no tombstones, no Lovecraft. Just these normal dudes joking around, drinking beers and jumping into quarries. There was no mystery. No unknown. Peter Fader has a Facebook page where he runs a victim advocacy group. People think Peter is an online bounty hunter who cannot reveal his physical identity for legal reasons. I tell people I'm looking for Roger Blair on behalf of the Bronson boys family. Not an outright lie. I am the family. I am Basement Boy. And I hear from dozens of people who knew Roger, people who think they spotted him. I have pictures, war stories, former students ready to testify that he made them feel uncomfortable. But I still can't find the motherfucker. Roger Blair was a loner, but even people like that have to confide. Everyone has someone. Roger never married, and as far as I can tell, his closest friend was the head of the biochemistry department at Brown, that meanie guy. I actually saw him at the police station when I got out. He was a person of interest when they started looking for Mr. Blair, but he was cleared right away. Shakayla said it was a no-brainer because Meanie banned Roger from the Brown campus. I remember him on the local news, outside of the station, almost smiling. You allow adults to be near children with minimal vetting, and you want to point at me? I don't think he's in cahoots with Roger, but I know he has to know something. They were close until they weren't. People who know you, they know your places. Same way Chloe and I had the shed. Roger and Meanie were research partners. They were on this Animal Planet show, The Machiavellian Life of Plants, a few times. They talked about biochemistry, this plant called the dodder vine, a parasitic weed that sucks energy, life essentially, out of others to survive. They saw the potential for power in this, and they were also interested in the photosynthetic potential in mankind. They had this idea that people could one day be more like plants and sustain themselves on sunlight and soil, become a part of the ecosystem. Roger's reasoning was that with technology, we don't use our bodies as much. We're down to eyes and fingertips. This is where Meanie was the normal one, who would audibly groan and correct his partner. What he means is that there is more untapped energy in other parts of our bodies. They got a lot of grant money, but nothing ever panned out as far as I can tell. Blair was notorious for dropping one project to start another, and the two squabbled about research ethics a lot. My dad would say they're a couple of Garfunkels with their high voices and curly hair, but Meanie is camera ready. It's not surprising that he wound up with the job, the power. In the video with the most hits, Meanie calls Roger a sadist, and warns the host that Roger will hurt someone someday. Roger Blair rolls his eyes. People who live to know a sicko are very eager to tell you their story. There's a pride, a sense of having survived someone. I hear from people every day who knew Roger, and they all say the same thing. You should find Meanie. He knew Roger better than anyone. And every day I call. I pretend to be a student, a professor, a reporter, but it's always the same. Dr. Meanie suggests you visit during his office hours. Dr. Meanie is preoccupied with research at the moment. Dr. Meanie does not speak with reporters. If I wasn't poison, I could go to him during his office hours. Of course, I think about blowing my cover. I am John Bronson, the guy who was kidnapped by Roger Blair, and I think Dr. Meanie can help me. But I don't trust him. Look how he treated Roger, his best friend. Look at him now, talking to a girl in front of the Dean Hotel. They were drinking, eating. The girl is not his wife, and who knows if he's sleeping with her. But his smile is for her. His hand is on her elbow. I follow him every day, trailing him on the way home, where he kisses his wife, his dog. He's so available. I could knock on his door, stop him when he's emerging from his biweekly squash games at the campus gym, tap him on the shoulder. But I can't do that without the risk of killing him. What I can do is what I do every night at this hour. I pick up my papers and start my shift. My favorite part is Hope Street. There's a girl who lives in this old Victorian. Crane, comma, Flory. That's what I call her in my head, the way her name looks on her paper. Her car is plastered with bumper stickers. Keep Providence weird. Hugs, not horns. It's like she's trying to talk to the world with her little red sedan, hoping somebody beeps back. I've never met her before, but last Christmas she gave me a pair of gloves with a special finger fabric that lets you text. So you can stay in touch while you help us stay in touch. Merry Christmas, Theo. I kept the card. It's on my fridge. Most people don't give you anything at all. So I do nice things for her. When it rains, I double bag her paper. I use 2 twist ties. When my shift ends, I park by the Brown Chemistry Building. I like watching it come to life. Meanie meanders down the street with his travel mug, and I can't see him once he swipes his card and enters the building. But soon enough, he appears in his window on the 2nd floor at his standing desk, where he stretches his arms above his head and starts his day, which always includes ignoring me. Still, I try. His assistant, Patty, answers. She's new this month, but we already have a rapport. When I say hello, she sighs, exaggerated for my benefit. Peter, you know what I'm going to tell you. But I have a good feeling, Patty. I just need 2 minutes. She puts me on hold, and I watch as she goes to Meanie, as he waves her out of the room. He's in a meeting, she says, and then she lowers her voice, asks me when I get back from Stockholm. I forgot that I told her I'm on a semester abroad. It was my explanation for why I can't visit him in person. The sun is getting stronger and the streets around me swell with students. Patty, I say, pleading, I'm not a reporter. I'm just a psych student and a victim advocate. We just want to ask him a few simple questions. I know, she says, and I'm telling you, Meanie would help you if you walked into this room. He doesn't speak publicly about Roger Blair, but we all know how he feels, and I know he would come through. She sighs. Peter, she says, he's that type. You just have to see him face to face, you know? When I get home, there's a box waiting for me out front. I climb down the stairs into my hovel and tear into the package. It's a hat I ordered. I forgot all about it. A baseball cap with 3 words sewn onto it. I am Providence. That's what it says on Lovecraft's tombstone. I put on my new hat, and I put on the middle. The wanting overwhelms me, the way it does sometimes. I hit the mute button, and I feel my heartbeat quicken as I dial her number. I know I shouldn't. I know she's moved on. She's in New York. I could kill her if I walked up to her, if I saw her, if she saw me. I have to stay away from her until I'm fixed. I have to stay away from everyone. But sometimes you need someone. Sometimes it's enough to call my parents. I only stay on for a minute. It's too hard to hear their voices. But the last time I called, my mom said, "We haven't heard from her in ages." Time changes people. She picks up. "John?" Chloe says. "Is that you? Please talk to me. You don't have to tell me where you are. It's me. I'm alone." I lose my body to my distorted heart. The thing that keeps me alone, alive. It's like my dream where her paint runs through my veins. Her breath is in my lungs. I'm lost in her voice. So lost that I don't realize it when I unmute the sound on my TV. And TV is louder during commercials, especially this one, an earworm jingle for a furniture store downtown. Alex Interiors will come to your home. Shopping is tough. Alex Interiors. You're never alone.
Chloe. I Googled Alex Interiors while we were still on the phone. It's a chain of furniture stores in Rhode Island. There are four of them in the Providence area. And now I know for a fact that John is in Providence, that he didn't want me to know. He hung up when he knew I could hear. And now I can't sit still. I'm pacing around my apartment, pulling at the curtains, looking out the windows. He does this every once in a while. Tonight, I picked up on the first ring. "John," I said, "is that you? Please talk to me. You don't have to tell me where you are. It's me." I held the phone like a seashell. "I'm alone." I'm never far from my phone because every time might be the time he finally talks to me, the time he tells me why he ran, where he went. I've made my life an open book for him. My address, my phone numbers, my website giving advance notice of every move I make, every show. I think of that word, feed. I've tried so hard to feed him. Everything is an invitation. Come home, John. Come back. And now I'm reading about Providence. There's a Tenleys in that city. My heart beats. This is why I've never had a boyfriend, because of these nights wandering, hunting. I've put myself out there. I've had my flings, my flirtations, but I've never been able to make things stick with any other guy. They feel me drifting, and they never want to stay the night. I always kiss them goodbye, whimpering, "I'm married to my art." They don't come back, which is fine. They know I'm not available. It's a thing you can feel. I'm buoyed to this process, the search, the wonder. My freshman roommate in college thought I was nuts. She said so to my face. "You can fry your brain if you keep the phone on your pillow." When that didn't work, she sent me articles about how phone chargers and bedsheets can lead to house fires. I lived alone the following year. And then in my senior year, that reporter from The New Yorker called about a "Where Are They Now?" story on missing kids. I told him I didn't know where John was. They wanted to put one of my paintings on the cover. I said yes. And then my life became what it is now. I'm an artist. I really am. I'm not a struggling painter, and I'm not a paralegal who takes sculpture classes in her spare time. I make money doing what I love, and it's a wonderful thing, an obnoxious thing, always waiting for the knock on the door. "There's been a mistake. This isn't your life." And then there's the reality of how I got where I am. Because of him. because I missed him. I missed him, and I drew him, and it could very well be that my art wouldn't have hit without my story. Our story. The one I told to so many reporters. I could call his mother and tell her about Alex Interiors, but she hates me. She's called me a vampire and a parasite, an exploitative hack. You made a profit off my son's tragedy. My cheeks burn. My heart races. All the memories. How hard I tried to help. How many flyers I posted all over town, online. The pictures I drew of him. I still draw him on his birthday. I've sent a portrait to his parents every year since he vanished. I took a goddamn class on police sketches so that I could better imagine him now, older, how a nose changes, how skin sags. Last year, when I paid to run an ad in the Globe, she huffed, "Well, you must be doing well with your art, having that kind of cash to throw around." It stings. And she's not the only one to make that accusation. But she never liked me. And I know there's a little truth in there. I hesitated over the years. I worried that there was something inherently corrupt about my whole life. But that's true of everyone, everywhere. There's John's father. I could call him, but I know it's a waste. He never recovered from the first time around. When I think of him, I still see him in the woods, drunk, singing his old songs, preparing for his son to be gone because it's easier than hoping he's coming home. I could call Alexandra, my assistant, the person I pay to groan at me. "Chloe, don't read the comments. Chloe, you gotta put your phone down. Chloe, you need to get out." She's cool, literally. Her hands are always cold. Not an obsessive bone in her body. I can't call her right now. I don't want to wake her up. I also don't want a rational, cool girl telling me that it was probably a wrong number. It was him. I know it. I lie down on my bed. Providence. Sometimes I think it's my fault. I say too much when he calls. I feel too much. It's like I'm being pulled underwater, and I cringe when I hear myself say his name, my voice turning like milk in the fridge. He was missing when we were kids, but this is different. This time he left. I'm the missing person. That's what I do all night, all day. I miss him. He's in my skin, my sleep, the unfinished feeling, the wonder. But now I have a clue. Alex Interiors will come to your home. Shopping is tough. Alex Interiors, you're never alone. I pour a shot of tequila. I mark his call in the notepad on my phone. The first time he called was the month after Noelle died. I was still reeling, staring at her Dartmouth pen every day, feeling the bite marks. The two people I knew best were gone, ripped away. I wondered if I was cursed, indulged in this dark fantasy of me, the poisonous one. And then my phone rang, as if he was reading my mind, as if he knew I needed him. It was 2:45 a.m., "John," I said, "I know it's you." He hung up right away. There's no pattern, no way to make sense of his calls. The timing isn't romantic. He doesn't call on my birthday, on Christmas. This is how you drive a hamster nuts in an experiment. You give it treats for no reason, at random. You don't let it learn how the system of rewards works. I look at the painting I was working on, the painting I can't even look at right now, the painting I can't finish, because now my mind's on John.
John, I shouldn't be calling her. And it's stupid that part of me expected her to show up in Providence. Stupid that I wanted to go to Alex Interiors and wait for her. But I looked the place up online, and there are 4 showrooms in the city, and there's only 1 of me, and beyond that, above it all, I know what could happen if I were to see her. Holder, I'm supposed to be finding Blair, learning about what he did to me, how it can be undone. This isn't one of those stories where she and I fix things together. I was kidnapped, not her. I am poisonous, not her. I have to do this. Not her. I put on my new hat. I am Providence. It would be easier to stop calling Chloe if I didn't know so much about her. I've seen her on Facebook, pictures of her, videos. I've watched her go to college, to New York. I saw her on the Today Show after the world went crazy over her New Yorker cover, and she became this overnight adult, this artist. And her hair got even shinier and her art was for sale. She's let me into her whole life. Her apartment, the pictures she posts of random things in her kitchen. I know what her coffee maker looks like, and I know what my eyes look like from her perspective. She tells people I'm the reason she's an artist. She was drawing pictures of me for the police, trying to keep me alive with her paintbrush, her pencils. You could even say that my going away was the best thing that ever happened to her. People do say that kind of stuff in the comments of the articles about her. But other people stand up for her. You're forgetting the fact that she clearly loved the guy and was drawing him because she missed him so much. It's not like she put him in the basement. Duh. Sometimes the other people are me. I make up a fake name. I get in there. She's not married. She doesn't have a boyfriend. She keeps all of her pages open to the whole world, and sometimes it feels like that's a magic trick, that every time she looks into a camera with those searching eyes, she's looking at me, for me, wanting me to know she misses me. After I called her, she posted a blurry photo of the moon with no caption. I'm pretty sure that was for me. I pick up my coat. I gotta eat something that doesn't come out of my freezer. And it's finally late enough for me to be out in the world. One thing I've noticed about my power, if that's what you want to call it, it's nothing without my feelings. If I don't get worked up, agitated, or excited, if I'm chill, then I can do things like get a snack, go for a walk. People in the middle of the night are mostly mellower. They're tired. They keep to themselves. They don't look at you if you don't look at them. And if one of them does look at me, if I do start to feel something, anything, then I know by now what I have to do. I have to run. Fast. I forgot about Thirsty Thursday. College kids get wasted at the bars and the parties, and then they want falafel. They're all so together in heaps. I remember thinking I'd go to college and be in a heap of people. And it's weird to see the heaps, the Madras shorts, the brown crew windbreakers, and know that Roger or no Roger, this never would have been my life. I walk slowly. I keep my head down in a crowd and pretend to be doing things in my phone, like some random guy would. In the notepad part of the phone, I write to Chloe as I walk inside. What's up? Nothing. Just waiting for falafel. I couldn't help it. You know when you gotta have it, you gotta have it, huh? How are you? Because my head is down, I don't see the guy. I bump into him, or he bumps into me. I don't know how it begins, whose fault it is. I only know that he drops his falafel, splunk, and the sauce spatters. He screams, fuck! His shorts are plaid, and his legs are long, and his eyes are wide, and he smells like beer spilled on a floor and then attacked by a mop. I bend over to pick up the falafel, but he kicks it like a soccer ball. The fuck is your problem, you pussy? You walk around with your head in your phone, walking into people? The fuck is wrong with you? My heart is starting to tick in the bad way, and his friends are gathering, and there are too many people. So many people. Sorry, I mumble and put my phone in my pocket. Burger King has a drive-through. I can go there. I should go there. I will go there. I start to walk, but he pushes me.
The fuck do you think you're doing, phone boy? You just walk in, walk out?
I'm sorry. He mocks me.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Some of his friends laugh, and some have their phones out, and a girl slings her arms over a guy's back. I have to leave. My heart is involved, and I know what will happen if I don't leave now. I say I'm sorry again, and I start to walk, but he grabs my shoulder.
No.
His hand is too big and strong, and he won't let me go, and his friends want him to calm down. They say his name. He has so many names. Krish, and Potter, and Swain, and Krish P, and Krish P Cream. And he is spitting at me, swearing at me. I try so hard to calm down. I say my sorries, and every time I go for the door, he stops me. His hand. His big hand. There is a wall of mattress and spandex and shiny windbreaker material, and I can't get through it, and my heart is on fire. The first blow is to the back of my head, and I hit the ground hard. There is screaming and giggling, all the nervous sounds, scared sounds. Some people want this and cheer, and others are afraid. The falafel guy at the counter, he's calling the police, and I can't move. I hear my ribs crink and my face sploosh. I smell my own blood as he turns me over, punches me in new places now, my cheek, my chest, telling me this is real life, not your phone, you piece of shit. I try to stop my heart before it can stop his. His friends try and pull him off me, and they can't. I can't. They can't. Oh, no. No. Alarms sound all over my body, and my heart churns. Oh, no. I think of Krish as a kid I would have wanted to be friends with. Even as he punches me in the ribs, crink. I think of him as an old man deep into the future, but my heart beats faster and blood leaks from my cheeks, split open. He knees my groin. By now I know what it feels like when my heart takes over. The earthquake inside when the jets fly out of me and they zoom into him. And he can't punch me anymore. His nose bleeds. His eyes freeze up. And only I am close enough to hear the death rattle, the breath caught in his throat as he stops breathing, stops living, sinks onto my body. Funk. He is dead. I know it, and nobody else knows it yet. And I am stronger by the second. I can hear my ribs reconnecting, feel my skin resealing. A fast-forward video of a scab healing. You have power. You're welcome, John. There is screaming now as people try to figure out what happened, as if I stabbed him, as if I did something. I tried to leave. I did. The heaps of people come to save him because he is the friend, and I am the alone guy, the random guy that nobody knows, scrambling to my feet. I am healing up so fast, the fastest rewind you can do, and I have to get out before the mattress people realize what I did, what seems impossible, what should be impossible. To kill someone without a knife, without a weapon, without a fist even. To kill someone with your insides, your heart. This is mean magic. My body took his energy and used it to pull my skin back together. To line up my ribs. I back away from the heaps of people, the screaming and the crying and the swarm of plaid, the love, the squeak of their jackets and the shrieking. And there is a girl, and she's gonna ask me if I'm okay. I can feel it, feel her eyes, her wonder. I have to go. Now. I grab my phone, my hat. I am Providence. It doesn't matter what I meant to do. It only matters what I did.
Eggs. It's almost 3 when I hear Lo up and puttering. It sends my whole body into high alert. I don't know how anyone gets through life alone. If she died, I'd be dead straight away. We'll be those people you read about where one goes, The other goes within 72 hours. She'd be okay without me, though. If I croaked, she'd keep teaching, keep going to events, keep buying coffee. I think that might even be why we're such a good fit. Someone's got to be the iceberg, and someone's got to be the sun. She's walking up those stairs, not charging. This won't be a fight. She yawns in the doorway. Beautiful.
Your phone's ringing, Eggie,
she says, handing it to me. If I was 40 instead of pushing 50, I might silence the phone and make a move, stop her on her way back downstairs. But sometimes when you're 50, it's enough to know what you do to the woman in your life. You don't necessarily have to do it. With a sigh, I answer the call. De Benedictus, I say into the phone. It's Joanne, the night dispatcher. There's an incident on Thea Street, a call to arms. I always feel guilty leaving Lo, but she will nestle into the sofa. She has her kids, her papers. Downstairs, her eyes follow me to the unnecessarily wide entrance to our home, the kind of hallway that requires a response from people because they immediately feel thrown off by the expansiveness. Imagine living there. Imagine they thought they'd have all these kids. Ugh, next time they're coming to our place, not so depressing. Now where are you off to?
A frat boy dropped dead on Thayer Street.
Brown kid?
Yeah, apparently there was a whole to-do.
Sounds like drugs, she concludes.
I pick up my gun off the table, my piece that would be locked up if we had a kid. I feel a little guilty about being so excited to leave. Ever since the business with Chucky, it feels like the job description changed. I used to get a call and think, God, no, a dead body, an awful thing, some tragedy, something bad. It's a funny thing. What changes when your life changes? The split second of gratitude that someone else got fucked over, knowing that this time around I just might be able to make a damn difference, find some goddamn justice, make sense of things, get the goods, answers, peace, righteousness.
Be careful, officer,
she winks at me, a little jab at Marco. In the car on the way to Thayer Street, I'm at ease, humming even, thinking about what it would be like to be on my way to Bradley. And the mere thought is enough to throw me. I run a stop sign. Someone beeps, fucking asshole. Yep. You always want a witness like Romy O'Nan. Pragmatic. In the scene, but outside of it. She's the coxswain on the crew team, which means she's about a foot shorter than everyone else, inherently ostracized, observant. And she had a crush on the deceased, so she was watching him like a hawk. She doesn't say it, doesn't have to. I can see it in her eyes every time she looks over at the body, back at me. Romy wanted a chance with Krishna Pawan, senior, rower, God. And now she's not going to get it. You forget about death, how it kills other people's dreams. As she said when I got here,
me and Krish talked a lot tonight, more than we ever had. I still can't believe this. Like that this happened now, on this night of all nights. It's not fair. I know how stupid that sounds. And I know I'm in shock, but I mean,
people are human, and humans are selfish. We have to be.
Little Romy, she just meant that she thought she was going to get this guy in the sack tonight.
Not that he'd stay. She's smart, a squeaky thing, freckled, lonesome. But she thought she was going to have a night. It's easy to imagine her older, with someone more like her, forever longing for that night with Krish.
A heart attack?
She asks again. The other kids are bawling and hugging each other, but Romy sticks by me, makes her feel closer to the Vic, like she's his person. Other kids, they got what they wanted out of him, and they can wail, moan, they can mourn. Romy wants more. Romy, I say, if it's any consolation, this is a horrible, freakish thing that happens. You know, I've seen four kids like Krish, maybe not quite as young, but young, 22, 24. Seen them all die suddenly for no reason. She shakes her little head.
No, but Krish is an athlete.
I nod. I know the script. He probably had a heart condition.
He didn't, she says. He was ridiculously healthy.
Nobody's immune.
No, she says. This is insane. This is not happening.
I know how it feels, I tell her. But this is the problem with the human body. It lets you down, one way or another. My dad always said the only guarantees in life are death and taxes.
Did you look at him?
She asks.
He was in perfect health.
The same way they describe some people as being larger than life, Romy is smaller than life, drowning in an oversized windbreaker. The way mothers call their daughters their mini-me's. That's what I'd call Romy, a mini-me. There's got to be a bigger version out there, life-size. She keeps on that Krish was special. He was going to be in the Olympics. Gently, I ask if there's any chance he'd taken anything harder than a shot of fireball tonight. She gets teary.
We literally just bonded over how we've both never done coke, she says.
And then she starts crying. The last few heart attacks were different. Smaller crowds, quieter streets. The dead people, they weren't in college. They weren't going to be in the Olympics. The other heart attacks I've seen in the past few years, the young ones, the people weren't special. Well, Yvonne Belziki, but I can't go thinking about her again. All of the heart attacks, they were fine, like anyone. All of us plopped onto this planet with crummy hearts, hearts that break in the end no matter what you do. Romy's just not old enough to realize that. Until tonight, she thought death was for grandparents and goldfish. She blows her nose. I tell her she can take all the time she needs. My job is like any quest in life. You get the best story from the person who wants to talk, not the one who has to talk. And now she's ready. All business.
Okay, she says. The first thing you should know, tonight only happened because of Ellen.
Romy explains that Ellen is an art fuck who goes to RISD. She and Krish were dating, seriously. Earlier today, Krish found out Ellen was cheating on him with another art fuck, also from RISD. Romy says Krish was a wreck.
We got together to party and take his mind off it, she says, and it was working. We got a keg, and we played Beirut. He was okay. But then this hipster dick, you know, the type with a beard and a hoodie and a hat, ugh. He walks in, totally oblivious, barges into Krish.
Did you know this guy with the beard? The words click with me right away. The beard. I write them in my pad for no reason other than that thing in your gut, that voice that says, the beard. Romy says nobody knew the hipster. I ask if Ellen might have known the beard, and she rolls her eyes. The guy she's been cheating with is the other kind of RISD art fuck, the bald, skinny guy. This guy was huge. I write it down. Huge. And then Krish snapped, she says. He just started beating the guy. The guy fight back? The beard? She shakes her head. Did the bearded man provoke him in any way, verbally, at any point? No, she says, which is actually weird because the guy was big. Not Krish big, but, you know, he just took it, like a lump. She starts to cry again, and I lie to her again. It's okay, honey. It's okay. It isn't. It isn't. She wipes her eyes. Look, she says, Ellen literally broke Krish's heart. That's the only way I can believe that he had a heart attack.